A quick notice to listeners. Part of the discussion on this podcast delves into a standoff over the state health plan. After it was recorded, State Treasurer Dale Falwell relented on his move to transform how the plan reimburses hospitals for procedures. His decision came after two self-imposed deadlines had passed. You can read more about the health plan and Falwell's decision at WUNC.org. And now, enjoy the episode.
Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sane, Hastings, Martin, Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the Fourth Estate Bunker on West Jones Street in downtown Raleigh, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. Glad to have you along as always. I'm Jeff Tiberi in the hot seat today. WRAL State House reporter Travis Fain getting us caught up to date on some, if not all, of the things that are moving in NC Paul and beyond this week. Hi, Travis. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
39 days into, you're welcome, and thanks for being here. 39 days into the fiscal year, there is no new state budget. There is no end in sight. I don't think there is much for us to talk about, but we'll just tick it off the list at this beginning juncture of the podcast. Anything to say about the continued impasse, stalemate, standoff, call it what you may?
I think that it's going to continue for a while to come. Things just have not cooled off enough yet to kind of get down to business between Republicans and the governor. You were there, I think, when we spoke to the speaker earlier today, Thursday. And he said he, you know, hasn't actually talked to the governor. It sounded like 2 weeks, I believe he said.
Yep.
And you know, they're still kind of the sniping at each other on Twitter from staff and lawmakers. And Darren Jackson, the House Minority Leader, sent the Speaker a letter last night ish.
Yeah. Signed by 51 of the 55 Democrats,
indicating, "Hey, look, you're not going to be able to override this thing. Let's move on." The Speaker not ready to move on. But obviously, I mean, that would be quite the thing if a Democrat signed on to this letter and then flipped and voted against the governor. And I don't know that Republicans are going to be able to catch Democrats in a situation where not enough of them are there. It would take so many of them being absent for Republicans to be able to kind of slip this past them. So I think we're just going to wait for a while.
So this was part of what Speaker Tim Moore had to say on the House floor today.
Well, we certainly appreciate the letter, but we're going to continue the work that we're doing. We're going to continue going out in the communities around the state to talk about how great this budget is, and I'm going to continue to try to convince Democrats that this is a great budget that they should vote for, notwithstanding the objections of the governor.
So that was House Speaker Tim Moore on the floor of the North Carolina House Thursday morning, and that's not, you know, oh yeah, we're negotiating this thing and we have moved through these steps and we're now talking about this portion of the budget, or we've made some headway, or we're even having a conversation. This is, I'm over here, I'm doing my thing, I'm going to take my case to the people, going to keep on doing that, and they're going to try to either convince some Democrats or hope that as summer carries on and drifts to fall, they can shrink the chamber enough to have 3/5 of those present vote for an override. And at this point, I mean, I throw my palms up in the air as to whether or not we get the veto, override. Eventually, there's some sort of negotiation. Or if, and I don't mean to be hyperbolic, it's 2021 and we're talking about this budget or a new budget finally getting signed in.
Take your pick, right?
Right.
I mean, we just don't know. It'd be interesting to see what happens when school starts, which is 2 weeks away, for at least for my kids, I believe. Late August, you know, will that spark a conversation about teachers not getting their raises, which would lead to a broader conversation about the budget not being in place? Who does that hurt?
Right.
I guarantee you people are running that math on either side of this thing. I'm not the kind of person who feels comfortable saying who's going to win that calculation.
Right. And for context, 4 years ago, there was a budget standoff. It lasted till the end of September, and oftentimes I am a state employee, and oftentimes has been the case for us as employees of the university system. Sometimes those raises don't come until later in the year. And when they have come, they have been, in my experience, as I just think about it from the hip, they've been retroactive to July 1st. So it is possible that whenever those raises come, they will come retroactively in a lump sum. However, still not coming in the meantime.
And people knowing that, people being kind of used to that a little bit, you know, this not being everybody's right. first rodeo, that might help allay some of those concerns.
Right. Let's move on. The latest mass shootings took place in our country just a few days ago. There was El Paso. There was Dayton. There were 22 people that died in West Texas. Just hours later, there were 9 people that died amazingly, terrifyingly in just 32 seconds in Dayton, Ohio. I think in a little bit of context that I want to include as we get into this conversation is also last weekend in the city of Chicago. There were, I believe it was 32 different shootings across less than 2 days. 7 people were killed in shootings, not mass shootings per se. I mean, this is more domestic. It's gang related. It's on the west side of Chicago. A lot of it, not all of it. It was the deadliest weekend that Chicago has seen in 2019, which is just to say there is the mass shooting piece of it. There's also just gun violence. It's prevalent in this country. You mentioned the speaker a moment ago. We gaggled with him. We spoke to him for a little while this morning. It was one of the only times I can remember. I think I gave him the question just about, you know, what would it take for 2 pieces of legislation that Democrats here in the North Carolina House have proposed? What would it take for those to move forward? Fairly straightforward question. He spoke for probably 6 or 7 minutes. He went from the hip. And that's not something I've normally seen or seen with any frequency out of him. Trying to drop a little context in here. Everybody obviously knows what's going on. Does this issue remind you of anything else?
I don't know that it does. I mean, it's people get so passionate about it, and for very good reasons.
Mm-hmm.
We're hearing Chicago a good bit from Republicans right now. When, you know, mass shootings and gun violence in general, in my mind, they're typically 2 different issues, although I certainly see why
people push
them together.
Right.
But I'm not sure that the policies that may or may not be effective on mass shootings would have the same effect on gun violence more broadly, because you're talking about the difference between handguns, you're talking about large magazines. I mean, obviously, handguns are used in some mass shootings as well. It's not just the assault rifles.
Right.
The speaker, I mean, I think the long and short of what the speaker had to say was, you know, don't look for gun legislation out of this General Assembly.
Anytime soon.
I have thought, you know, House Bill 86 is one of the ones House Democrats want to move. That's kind of a grab bag of left-leaning ideas. Magazine limits is one of them. 3-day waiting period. I mean, it has been described to me by one Republican attorney as, you know, the New York and California bill, or even further left. But the other one, 454, that is a red flag law. Mm-hmm. You know, that's where the law enforcement can come and take your guns if you're thought to be a threat, and then you have to go before a judge within 10 days to get them back.
Right.
It's something not only that could address violence, but, you know, violence against yourself if you're a suicide risk, if your family thinks you're a suicide risk. And the speaker was indicating that he felt like with what you can do on a domestic violence protection order.
With 50B orders.
No, and with an involuntary commitment that we were covered. Talking to Marsha Morey after that, that's her bill, she was giving me some examples of where the holes in that are that she wants to fill. I'm going to try to write something about that on Friday. To put that out there for people.
Is there a gap that you could point us toward, as an example, something she mentioned to you, or do you want to hang on to that for now?
It sounded like there was. I don't know that I want to shoot from the hip on that. Okay. Forgive the pun.
No pun intended.
She did not think the laws were adequate now, this is such a nuanced area.
Right.
Because you get into a case-by-case situation. I mean, literally, you're going case-by-case. When you're talking about taking someone's guns and then having them make an argument before a judge.
Right, in a country where there is probably greater passion for firearms than any other country that I'm aware of.
And more firearms than people.
Right.
Like by a significant margin, we have more guns than people. And that, you know, I guess you could use that to argue either side of the issue, because I don't know how you put that genie back in the bottle.
So, and I guess to extrapolate the conflation, which I just did, I wasn't necessarily trying to conflate those two things, the mass shootings and then just the common gun violence that it's going to happen in Wake County at some point in the next few days. It's going to happen in various counties across the state of North Carolina. there are, I mean, there's an issue here. Like, there's a problem. Hopefully, honest, reasonable minds can agree that there is a problem. Now, what to do, whether to do X or Y, if those things are going to have results, I mean, that's where you get into the policy discussion. But there is this multi-pronged issue. And I was reminded again this week of the fact that based on, I think it's like half a dozen surveys that have taken place in recent years, there's roughly, it's about a 90% support from the American people for universal background checks. Now, we've had other things over, and I don't have a great example off the top of my head, but there have been other things that have a lot of support. Maybe Medicaid expansion is an example of something that has, maybe not from as many surveys, but Medicaid has had some support, some decent support. Democrats for sure, independents lesser so with Republicans, but 90% of Americans support background checks. So it's one of these, it's fascinating to see a number that is that high and not really even any policy movement on this. So anyway, that's, and if that's a soapbox, I apologize. It's not intended to be a soapbox, but there is a disconnect with, you know, the public support and what is happening.
We do see that disconnect on that issue and on others. I think one question I would have is, you know, you always have to look at the poll question, obviously. What does a universal background check mean to any given person?
Right.
We can talk about closing the gun show loophole, wherein if you go to a gun show or you have some other, you know, you meet a stranger and want to purchase a gun from them, they're not a licensed firearm dealer.
Right.
That's one thing. But, you know, another thing is, well, what if you want to sell me a gun or my cousin or my brother wants to sell me a gun? Is that included in universal background checks? And I think if you start to include that, which some bills do, some bills don't,
right.
Maybe support starts to erode a little bit. I don't know, you know, where the guns are coming from when a crime is committed, and then also when a mass shooting is committed. It's kind of a monumental task to piece that all back together.
Sure.
Some people have done it at times. I don't know how often I have seen, well, this gun that was used in this crime came from this purchase that happened without a background check.
Right.
So I you know, that is one that gets talked about a lot. I don't know how many problems that's going to close off.
Right. Right. Again, I throw my hands up, my palms up in the air to an extent. I hear from conservatives, Republicans who say it's important to talk about Chicago because Chicago has some of the tightest gun laws in the country. Now, that is true, and they also have some of the worst gun violence in the country. I think just a couple of points that demonstrate how complicated this is. At the same time, New York and Washington have pretty tight gun laws, and they have seen a decrease in gun violence over the last 20 years. Chicago is also close to other states. There's nothing Chicago can do about Indiana.
Yeah, what are the gun laws in the surrounding areas, I think, is the question there, and I think that's why a lot of people want to see federal action on this.
The shooting in El Paso, I don't think there's any reasonable denying that the person that orchestrated the shooting released a manifesto minutes before it took place. And there were a lot of commonalities, if not, you know, direct quotes from things the president has said, has tweeted, has indicated about people who have come to this country from other countries. I think some of these issues hit us personally in different ways at different times, but this was one that hit you particularly personally. You were married to a woman who is from?
The Dominican Republic. She grew up in New York, but was born in the Dominican Republic.
Okay. What was the conversation like with your children, if you're willing to, because you have two kids.
Yeah, there's seven.
What was this conversation like? And did it differ than the, I mean, do they generally ask you when these shootings take place? And
with the kids, we're still shielding them from stuff like this. I know those days are coming to an end. I mean, they've had, I think, a drill or two at school, which is heartbreaking to think that, you know, they're training for someone to come into their school and start shooting. But that's happening in schools. And, you know, there's a question of whether that's even a good idea, but that's not really what you're asking here. So with the kids, we're not talking about it. With my wife and I, we talk about it a little, but I mean, you're almost numb to these things mm-hmm. at this point. I can tell you, when Trump was first elected, my wife, you know, she became more distrustful of people because she felt like they were distrustful of her, that the vote showed that people with brown skin were not always welcome by white people. And I think I downplayed it maybe more than I should have. And so I try very hard to listen to what she has to say about these things and listen to what other people have to say, regardless of their skin color. I feel like we do so much talking past each other in this world these days, and maybe social media and just the pace of our society contributes to that. I try to listen. I try to see things from her point of view. And even as her husband, I'm not always successful in that. So that just tells you how hard it is to do.
On Twitter, at Travis Fain, TravisFain. Final thought on firearms and this story. As we said, I don't expect any legislation to move. But is there anything else you want to get into on this?
No, I mean, it is possible that the red flag could move in some fashion. It's kind of probably unlikely. It does sound like there's some rumblings on that at the federal level, some Republicans talking about it. This is the kind of issue where we've seen it come and momentum die away very quickly and repeatedly. So, you know, until we get past that hump. Yeah, right. I don't. You're right. I don't see it really passing.
One of the bigger stories in state news this week, state government, was a story that came out of WBTV television this week. Bill Roper, the interim president of the UNC system, replaced Margaret Spellings earlier this year. And the report from Nick Ochsner indicates that over the course of 7 or 8 years, Bill Roper didn't disclose that he made something like $3.6 million on a number of boards, corporate boards that he served on. And some of those boards at the same time were doing business with the state. I think we're going to something else that's quite political, the UNC system. This is something that I think we're going to start to hear. And maybe you already have. I haven't heard anything directly. I've been away for a few days. I think there are going to be a lot of people that say this is not something he can overcome in terms of being the president of the system long term. What are you keying in on or watching as this story develops?
It does seem like a real problem. You know, those statements of economic interest, they're kind of a hassle to fill out for people, I'm sure. But they're there for a reason. I had known he was at least on one of those boards, DaVita, and yeah. I may forgive me if I'm mispronouncing the company name. I did not realize the size of the payments, the amount of money that was flowing. And I think he was putting on these statements of economic interest forms the stock that he had in these companies, and says he was not participating in decisions on them. But, I mean, I think people are still going to look at it. There were some comments from Harry Smith, who's head of the Board of Governors, right, that, you know, first he tried to downplay it. This is not really a big deal, he told Nick. And then he told the Carolina Journal at some point, this might keep Roper from getting this job full-time or long-term, because right, he's kind of an interim right now.
Right.
And then he got walked back.
Right.
And I mean, the Board of Governors, that's a fraught situation just in general. Were there 22 of them or something like that on there? It's a large group.
And expanding. I mean, it's going to go up to 32 in the next several years, if I'm remembering correctly. And apologies if I'm mistaken.
It's so hard. We are so hopelessly outnumbered by the news that it is just so hard to keep things like that in your head, because these things change so many times. I mean, I was trying to write about the Board of Elections the other day, and which iteration is it? But anyway, I digress.
So your title, let's go off on a bit of a tangent here. Your title is State House Reporter. I was in Iowa for the last 3 or 4 days, 4 days, for a conference encouraging, trying to get reporters to use more science within their journalistic productions. Okay, great. Several people, I met reporters from across the country, it was a nice cross-section of print and digital and radio, and there weren't any television reporters there. But that's a slightly different conversation. I think that was mostly purposeful. Nothing against television reporters. Anyway, my question here is, when people say, what's your beat? How do you describe it? Because I got that question like 6 or 8 times this week. They're like, oh, hey, so what do you cover? And I was like, a little of everything. Like within state government. But there are some people that really just cover state houses or, you know, are on the government. How do you explain your job?
I say it's state government.
Yeah.
I say, and I wish I had more time to pay more attention to the executive branch and the agencies. You know, every now and then a Republican will say, well, you need to hold Governor Cooper accountable on this. You need to look at that. And I say, you need to go home so that I can. You know, when the legislature is not in session, that gives you an opportunity to look closer at those things. And I worry what we're missing because we're sitting around here waiting for a veto override that may never come. And, you know, the business of the people is dribbling through the process along with it. But, I mean, I try to think of that. I cover all state government. I wish I did more federal stuff. I don't think that we do enough in the media, the North Carolina media, of holding our members of Congress accountable or even informing people of what they're doing. A lot of times I'll reach out on an issue to them and I just won't hear back from some of them.
Right.
And it doesn't help that they know. I mean, what am I going to do about it?
Right.
You know, it's not like I'm there. Is there more than one reporter, Brian Murphy for McClatchy in Washington, D.C., is there more than one reporter looking at what is happening in D.C. from a North Carolina angle specifically? I can't think of a second one.
A reporter who is physically in D.C.?
Which is really the only way to do it.
Right, right. No, not that I'm aware of.
It's the only one I know of. So that's something I wish I did a better job of. I don't know when I would find the time. But I do want to do a better job of putting less important things down and picking more important things up in general.
You mentioned one of those state agencies. I want to just chat briefly, new topic here, about this ongoing, I have a colleague who's called it a game of chicken, which I think is a decent way of describing it, but this also kind of an impasse between some of the major hospital associations and State Treasurer Dale Falwell. And he has presented this as he is trying to change some of the pricing or change the pricing model for the state health plan and also increase transparency. Well, the hospitals have largely balked at this. They've said, no, we're not doing it. We're not playing along. Falwell has changed his – so he's trying to tether the pricing model to a percentage of Medicare reimbursements. Anyway, this hasn't gone anywhere. We've seen two deadlines come and go. And the result of this, if they don't reach a deal and if the hospitals don't buy into the state health plan, means that something like 720,000 state employees potentially are going to not have in-network coverage, which of course means a lot of money. Where does this go from here? I know there's legislation pending that could kind of kick this thing down the road a year. Do you have a sense of where things stand in this game of chicken?
Yeah, we're still early days in it, oddly enough. I mean, neither side seems willing to blink. You know, Falwell up the reimbursement, and then that deadline passed, and only five hospitals out of like 100. And he told me there were somewhere between 110 and 118 signed onto the system now. So obviously five is way, way too low.
Be about 4%, yeah.
I don't see a path forward on this either. Presumably one will present itself as we get closer to when this is supposed to take effect, January 1st. And who knows, maybe we end up in some sort of lawsuit. He has repeatedly accused the hospitals of cartel-like behavior, basically saying they're boycotting him. You know, they're all together in a way that maybe is laying the groundwork for some sort of antitrust accusation against the hospitals. The hospitals have said he has been just unwilling to work with them, that he is so married to this issue. But, you know, back in 2012, I worked for the Greensboro News and Record, and I asked for the contract that Blue Cross Blue Shield, which runs the state health insurance plan day to day. It's self-insured, and the treasurer oversees it, but Blue Cross Blue Shield, they do the blocking and tackling, and they negotiate these contracts with these hospitals. And when I asked for the contract, which I thought would be a public document, they gave me what they gave, something similar to what they gave Falwell, and it was a lot of pages where they just totally blacked out.
Right.
And that's because they don't want you to know what the insurance company is paying the hospital, and that's the sort of transparency that Falwell is pushing for. Along with a lower bill, just in general.
But he doesn't have enough allies at this point to carry the oomph to stand up to and persuade the hospitals.
I don't know how you do it because, I mean, state employees have to be able to go to hospitals. They have to be able to go to doctors. I think something like 28,000 out of some 61,000 providers, which, you know, mostly is going to mean doctors, have signed on. But that's still that's a big hole.
Right.
I don't know how he pushes that through. Senator Berger, obviously the leader in the Senate, has said he does not want to take up the delay bill that you mentioned.
Right.
So kind of count him with Falwell. The State Employees Association has been with Falwell. How that translates to all state employees, I don't know. I know the teachers, the NC, North Carolina Educator, Association of Educators, they put out a statement the other day that kind of was nudging Falwell a little bit. So this is going to be a big deal for state employees. And like you said, there's 720,000 plan members. The ones that are affected by this is actually more like 470,000.
Okay.
You have to back out some older folks because retirees are in there too, people who are on Medicare Advantage plans.
Gotcha.
I don't fully understand it, but I know there's a back out there.
You understand on a deeper level than I do. All right. Ticking through a number of things here on the WNC Politics Podcast with Travis Fain, State House reporter from WRAL. A few quick ones before we let you on your way. One Twitter follow, non-political, apolitical, somebody outside of the political realm, but someone you follow or something you follow on Twitter, which is interesting and engaging.
I'm a big college football guy, so I like the nation's only college football podcast, which is how they describe it, which is not true. It's called the Shutdown Fullcast. Mm-hmm. A lot of it's SEC football. One of the guys that runs it is at EDBS on Twitter, EDBS.
Yep,
so I'll recommend that if you like smart aleck college football coverage, and even though he went to Florida.
Your Bulldogs play at Sanford Stadium in beautiful Athens, Georgia. Other than that, because I'm sure that's your favorite college football stadium, what is your favorite college football stadium?
Oh, what a great question that is. And I don't know. Does the Rose Bowl count? We got to go to the Rose Bowl this past year.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
And that is every bit as wonderful as advertised.
You went with your wife and kids or with your family?
No, just me.
Just you?
Just
that's
me.
Awesome.
Well, and friends. But yeah, family.
93,000 of them or whatever it holds. Did you go for the Rose Bowl or did you see UCLA like regular season?
No, I went for the Rose Bowl when Georgia played Oklahoma.
Oh, that's right. Sorry. Yep.
In last year's Rose Bowl. Yeah.
I took my dad almost 10 years ago now. We saw Ohio State and Oregon. We did the parade in the morning and the game in the afternoon. It was awesome. Anybody that's a college football fan should try to do that at some point.
Not everything lives up to its billing in this world, but that one does.
If you're going to spend a week traveling around Iowa, I was just there, so I'm emphasizing Iowa, this podcast. People are going to love it. I can feel it. It's going to trend. It's going to be part of the brand. If you were going to spend a week traveling around Iowa with any one Democratic presidential candidate, who would it be?
Oh, man. I got to go with Buttigieg.
Yeah?
Yeah. He
because he's at home in the Midwest?
He's interesting.
He is interesting.
I find him to be the most interesting of those candidates. But a lot of them are interesting. A lot of them have kind of compelling stories. Cory Booker has kind of come on lately and shown some fire. It's going to be fascinating to watch the winnowing of that field.
And I think a lot of it's going to happen in the next 5 or 6 weeks before this next debate, because there's a new threshold. And I mean, theoretically, the next debate stage is only going to have like a third to a half as many people. So that should help with that process.
Good, because it is difficult to watch these debates.
And I will only add for color, I've talked to a lot of scientists, spoke with a few farmers when I was out there, and had lunch one day with a reporter. I mean, several reporters had lunch with a reporter from the Des Moines Register and a State House representative from Iowa. And the reporter from the Des Moines Register said that he's covered, I believe this is either his fourth or his fifth election cycle. And somebody asked about Buttigieg, and he just said one thing that had struck him as being interesting was that he feels Buttigieg has garnered a lot of attraction, a lot of, and there's no pun there, a lot of people really have adopted his message, attached to some of his policies. And he said the fact that he has a husband is about the seventh or eighth thing you hear from people. He's like, it doesn't seem to really even be a factor in his candidacy at this point in Iowa, which this reporter who's covered a lot of national politics thought was very interesting. So anyway, that might be a throwaway. But
when things change, they change fast. That has been my experience with social issues. They don't always change for good, and there's usually a backlash.
Sure.
But it does seem like we fight.
And then swiftly.
And then we're just like, oh, okay.
Last one. What American state, which you have never visited, would you most like to go to? And why?
I've never been to West Virginia. And it seems very beautiful there. The pictures I see, the countryside.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I would pick that one because I've been to most of them. I've been to most of the states. I'd like to go back to Montana and Idaho.
Mm.
That's a beautiful guy. And I don't so think I don't know there. That I've ever been to Iowa.
Okay.
So maybe you know what, yep. In honor of our theme here, I should say Iowa.
Really appreciate you getting on board. Travis Fain reports on many things North Carolina politically related. He is based here at the legislature. He's a State House reporter for WRAL. Thank you, as always, Travis, for the conversation.
Thanks for having me.
And as always, thanks for listening. You can find this on-demand program wherever you get those podcasts, Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher. And don't forget to stay up to date with whatever is happening in the North Carolina political sphere at both WRAL.com and WUNC.org. For Travis Fain, I'm Jeff Tiberi. Enjoy your weekend.